chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our Chapel Hill neighbors, Joe and Terry Graydon, are world famous for their calm, practical health advice about how to live our lives better. And they do this through their public radio program, their newspaper column, and many best-selling books. But their new book has a title that's sort of a frightening warning. It's a little bit harsher than we're used to from the Graydons. And the title is, it gets your attention, it's Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. So, Joe and Terry Graydon, first of all, welcome. We're such a pleasure always to be with you all.
Great to be here, DG.
It's nice to be joining you.
And either as I'm listening on the radio to your program or when those wonderful rare occasions when we can get together. But people are talking about this title before they even get into the substance of the book. So what do you say?
Well, we've had a couple of physicians tell us, I'm not even going to open your book. That title has totally put my hackles up.
But it got their attention, right?
It did, and that is actually the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think we wanted to antagonize physicians. I mean, that certainly wasn't the point of the title, although clearly it is controversial. And we're not so naive as to think that it wouldn't have that impact. But really, the whole point of this exercise was to alert patients to this invisible epidemic that exists in the country today that most physicians will acknowledge is a problem. It's just that I don't think anyone has recognized how big a problem. So we start the book by saying that if three jumbo jets crashed today, it would make every evening news story. It would be headlines tomorrow. There would be an outcry. People would assume that there were terrorists on the loose. But if it happened again tomorrow, and then the next day, and every day for the next week, and then every day for a year, three jumbo jets crashing daily for a year, people would be outraged, especially if it wasn't because of terrorists, but because of malfunctions in the airplanes, because of pilot error, because of some kind of preventable problem. People would not tolerate it.
And they wouldn't get on a plane.
Right. Well, usually they wouldn't.
Unless they were desperate.
Yeah.
Because with that number of people dying every day, every week, every year, people would say, something has to change. We have to fix this problem. Well, that's how many people die every day, every year in this country from healthcare harm, from medical mistakes.
As I read your book, there are a lot of things that jumped up at me. And one of them was trying to come to the defense of the doctors. And, you know, all of us love – it's like congressmen. We all hate Congress, but we love our congressmen. And we might be critical of doctors, but our general practitioner is somebody we've come to love, respect his or her judgment. And so what I thought 100 years ago, maybe even 50 years ago, that many of the deaths that are described that are due to medical malpractice or medical mistakes would not have come up because there would have been a condition that was going to cause death that there was nothing there to help, and that the mistake is that the doctor or the other health provider today might have somewhere a good procedure that would rescue this person or make them healthy. And it's just there's just so much there that not everybody can call it to their attention.
It's certainly true that there are many more powerful interventions now than there were 50 years ago. But it's also true that some of the preventable deaths that are happening from very old-fashioned causes.
Well, let's turn back the clock 50 years. When I was growing up, doctors were not under the kind of time pressure that they are today. So it would not be unusual for you to go into your doctor's office, have an opportunity to talk about the family. How are the kids doing? You know, you'd have a little chance to get to know each other, reacquaint. And over the course of the next 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, or maybe even longer, the doctor would be able to sit and listen and do a complete physical examination. And by the end of that time, to the best of his or her ability, and it was mostly his in those days, come up with a diagnosis. Hopefully a correct one, although misdiagnosis is a common problem and was even 50 years ago. These days, doctors are under such time pressure because, and we can get into the systemic problems of the healthcare system, but in large measure because of the way insurance pays, the way Medicare or Medicaid pays, doctors have to see far more patients in the course of a day in order to make ends meet. They have so much overhead. They have to have people on their staff who do nothing but deal with the insurance companies. So anywhere from about 7 to 10 minutes might be a pretty typical office visit these days. When time is short, doctors interrupt patients after 20 seconds. The patient may not get to tell his or her full story, and that's going to increase the likelihood of misdiagnosis. So things have changed over the course of the last 50 years. When we discovered in the course of writing this book that there are over 100,000 misdiagnosed deaths, that is to say, people are misdiagnosed and that leads to their death, we were shocked.
How did you find, where are the statistics?
Well, all of these statistics come out of the medical literature, and they actually all are very well documented. There are people who are particularly interested in studying misdiagnosis, for example, and they look at the discrepancy between the diagnosis that the person had before they died and what is actually found on an autopsy, which is the best possible way to see if a misdiagnosis has happened. And they do find that there is a fairly consistent discrepancy of about, what is it, Joe, 25%?
Well, it runs anywhere from 15% all the way up to 40%.
What?
You go into the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking about mm-hmm. deaths. So mm-hmm. you go into the hospital and they decide you've got X.
Something bad,
something
probably.
Something pretty serious. And they treat you for X.
And you die.
And then they do an autopsy and they discover, oops, you actually had Y.
And you could have been treated for Y. And in some cases, had they treated you for Y, you might not be dead.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a misdiagnosis. And this is the heart of the question, is whether or not the misdiagnosis is something that every physician or diagnostician should know about, or whether this is one of those areas in which, look, not with the benefit of hindsight, but looking at it, that good people, educated people, and informed could disagree about the diagnosis.
Well, all you have to do is watch House.
Yeah, well, I do. Yeah, I watch it.
It's a wonderful television program. And, you know, House, Hugh Laurie, the actor who plays it, does this wonderful curmudgeon. And of course, the way it works on television is you have this very short period of time in which everybody gets it wrong except House. Right. And at the very end, you know, just before the credits roll, he comes up with the answer.
And that's going to save the patient's life,
of
course. Unfortunately, in real life, we don't have a House in every hospital. And
some people would say, fortunately, we don't have a House.
There's that, too. But the fact is that doing diagnosis is difficult.
Yeah.
There's no getting around that. But there are some things that patients can do to help doctors get it right.
I want to stick in with House for just a moment since you all brought him up. One of the points that you make in your book that was very important to me, and that is that collegial diagnosis is really good, and that one of the problems for doctors, I would call it the House complex, and that is I've got to be the one who gets it right, and I know what's right, rather than, you say, a skeptical doctor is really one who is in and one who questions and seeks help from his or her colleagues is the kind of doctor you'd like to have, because today no doctor can master everything.
You're so right. No human being can know everything that needs to be known to make a correct diagnosis. And so doctors do need to call on their colleagues. And actually, the episodes of House I've seen, he does. And they run through a number of diagnoses that are, you know, possible. And then they decide, oh, no, well, that's not working. That's not the right diagnosis. Let's go on to the next one. And one of the mistakes that doctors sometimes do make is to stick with their original diagnosis, even when the rest of the evidence doesn't match.
Dr. Jerry Grubman is one of our country's foremost physicians and writers. He is an oncologist at Harvard, and he's written a number of really marvelous books, one of which was called How Doctors Think. And in that book, he talks about something called anchoring. And what he means by that is that the doctor makes a fairly quick decision what's wrong with the patient and throws the anchor in and it lodges. And it's much harder to dislodge that anchor once you've decided the patient has X instead of Y.
Now, we should say that a lot of the times the doctor's right. You know, that snap judgment frequently is correct and will result in an appropriate treatment. But sometimes it's not, and that's when the problems occur.
Yeah. Well, we want to talk about some of the problems. We've talked about the title is Top Screw-Ups, and I want to talk about some of those top screw-ups. And we'll do that after Joe and Terry Graydon and I take a quick break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are our Chapel Hill neighbors, Joe and Terry Graydon. We're talking today. You all have written a book called Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them, but interspersed all through the book, you all can't help but give us patients good advice all the way through, and so we thank you for that. But what we're talking about is the title and the top screw-ups. You've got top 10 list, but what is the top medical screw-up?
The very top screw-up is when the doctor does not listen to the patient. Joe mentioned earlier that a doctor may interrupt a patient within 20 seconds or so because of the time pressure. And as a result, the doctor may not get to hear everything that is troubling the patient. Now, in order for a patient to counter that, there are a couple of things that we need to do as patients. For one thing, we really need to prepare well for our doctor visits and go in organized and ready.
Well, let me give you an example. My uncle, Uncle Leo, was a dairy farmer. He worked his entire life on a dairy farm all by himself. So you can imagine what that life was like, getting up early, 4 o'clock in the morning, milking the cows, and had all kinds of injuries, cut off his thumb at one point, kind of handled the problem himself. He was a tough guy, never complained. Well, later in life, he developed prostate cancer and at some point was put on an estrogenic drug called DES. We've all heard about DES. It's a controversial drug, but it's not uncommon to prescribe it to men with prostate cancer. And at some point, he started to develop a cough and chest pain, really bad chest pain when he coughed. And he went to the doctor, and he was complaining about this. And the doctor kind of blew it off and sent him home. You know, you have a cold or an upper respiratory tract, something or other. It continued to get worse to the point where he could not climb stairs easily without a sharp stabbing pain in his chest. He goes to the emergency department. They sent him home. Finally, he goes back and just says, look, I think I have a pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in the lung. Please check it out. That's exactly what he had. He could easily have died. But because he was an old geezer, you know, a lot of times older people are dismissed. They didn't put two and two together. DES, the estrogen, increases the risk for blood clots. He probably had what's called a DVT, a deep vein thrombosis, a blood clot in his legs. Broke loose, ended up in his lungs, and this happens often. So if you don't listen carefully to the patient and recognize in this case, here's a man who does not complain. When he shows up and says, I've got chest pain, I'm having trouble breathing, you need to pay attention.
One other thing about Uncle Leo that might have contributed is Uncle Leo did not like to get to the point quickly. He would tell you a story. and it was sometimes a long story. This is not the best way to approach a doctor visit.
So, number one, you need to tell your story and you need to prioritize so the doctor knows what's really important for you right up front, and you need to verify that the doctor has heard you.
Well, one of the ways you can do that, I mean, people have said, well, how do you make sure that a doctor has actually been paying attention and really has heard everything that you had to say? One of the things you can do is ask for a teach back. Ask the doctor to tell you what he or she has heard. And it might seem insulting to say, doctor, I'm not sure you were really listening. What did you hear? So instead of doing that, you can kill two birds with one stone and say, doctor, I'm not sure sometimes I forget to include everything. Could you please tell me what I told you so I can make sure I didn't leave anything out? Hey, you might have left something out. And that way you get to hear both, did you include everything, and did your doctor hear it all?
So you say it in a nice way that puts the burden. I'm not a good explainer, but could you tell me what you thought I said?
You've got it,
yeah,
DG.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll do that. Well, now, I'd ask you about one of the top screw-ups, and the top screw-up is a general one, and that is doctors are in a hurry. They don't hear what their patient's saying, don't listen, are not able to listen. But let me tell you what I thought, after reading the whole book, what I thought the top specific screw-up was, and that is wrongly prescribing or allowing patients to take medicines that are either not appropriate or that the two medicines intersect in a way that is very harmful. That would be the, if you had to get America's top medical screw-up, that would be it. Now, am I close or am I right?
I think you're on target.
Well, obviously, we start the book with a story about my mom's death at a very prominent hospital in this area. And she died indirectly as a result of a drug interaction. One medicine interacting badly with another medicine leading to a fatal outcome. That happens far too frequently. And what we discovered in the course of the book was that both physicians and pharmacists experience something called alert fatigue. And Terry will explain what that means.
Well, nowadays, a lot of doctors are prescribing electronically. So they've got a little gadget, you know, like a PDA that they hold in their hand and they, you know, put in your data and to be able to write the prescription. And something flashes up on their screen and it says, whoops, this patient is taking a drug that's incompatible. And this has happened to them enough times before that they say, well, that's not worth paying attention to. And they just override it. Same thing happens at the pharmacy. There are so many flags that come up on the computer as the pharmacy or the pharm tech is filling prescriptions that very often they say, this one's not important, I'll just override it.
I think that the mistake that patients make and families make is that they assume that there's a safety net, that they're always going to have somebody checking to make sure that these drugs aren't incompatible. And so I completely agree with you, DG, that it is the number one, or at least very high on the list of mistakes, are these drug interactions. But sadly, no one is really double-checking as well as they should, which is why the patient has to do part of that him or herself.
Well, it's interesting that what I would have said, had I not read your book, is that that's easy. Computers, can't expect any pharmacist or any doctor to know all of the potentially dangerous. No way. I mean, gosh, you've got a list of drugs I can't.
It's beyond an impossible human
you're
task.
Right.
So you say,
humans
okay, get a computer
this.
To check it. And that's
exactly.
That would be my idea. So it's been accepted. That's what they do. And the doctor gets an alert whenever there is a possible interaction. The problem is that those people who make the list say they'll put an alert even if there's a remote possibility. And so the doctor doesn't trust it.
There are too many possible interactions. And as a consequence, the doctor says, well, you know, this one's, I just have to deal with too many of these things.
We've all heard the story about the boy who cried wolf.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You cry wolf too many times. When the wolf really comes, everybody ignores it. I've likened it, and this is a little harsh, and I apologize for this, but if you're running late to an appointment and the light turns yellow, and you run the yellow light, and then it actually is sort of on the red side, but you made it through. You didn't get into any trouble, and no policeman caught you. The next time, you might do the same thing again. And maybe the third time, it actually turns red, and you run it anyway, because you're really in a hurry this time, and you get through, and nobody catches you. Pretty soon, you start running red lights on a regular basis. Well, I liken that to what goes on with these drug interaction alerts. Physicians and sometimes even pharmacists get these little red light warnings, and if they ignore them and nothing bad happens, they do it again. And then they do it again and again, and then sometimes people are harmed because of an interaction that should have been prevented.
And by the way, the person who ignored that warning may not find out if the patient is harmed.
So may not get a report.
May not get feedback saying really did result in a problem.
We're visiting with Joe and Terry Graydon about their new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. We'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Joe and Terry Graydon. Why don't we say Terry and Joe Graydon?
Oh, well, you can.
We should.
We should. And their book is Top Screw-Ups, Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. A controversial, provocative title. And, you know, speaking of this gender equality, one of the interesting features of your book that startled me and then I got used to it was that instead of recognizing that there are more and more female physicians, when you all are referring to physicians, generally you don't say, and he did this, and or you didn't don't say he or she did this. You just go to, and she did this, to refer to the general. Was that, Terry, did you insist on that, Terry?
Well, we usually do go back and forth when we're talking about physicians, pharmacists, or other healthcare professionals, because in fact, they are, and in fact, nurses now are increasingly both genders. So to pick one or the other is unreasonable.
So you go back. I've noticed the she's, but I just skipped over the he's.
I was going to say that stood out for you because you were expecting the other.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right. But there are he, you went, you know, and not all she's, but she's and he's, and I just got startled. Yeah, that shows what a sexist pig I am.
I don't think so.
No, I mean, but that was great. I want to talk some more about drugs, and I don't want to overlook a whole list of other mistakes that doctors make. But I was startled by the drug interaction, and it was not altogether the mistakes that doctors and pharmacists and other healthcare professionals make in giving us two pills that interact improperly, but as you all describe that mistake, you describe the unintended consequences of taking virtually every medicine, that there's nothing for free, that many of these medicines that we take commonly, you just have to say that might be a patient mistake for insisting on getting those medicines.
One of the mistakes that we worry about, and it's really a communal mistake rather than a doctor mistake, a pharmacist mistake, or a patient mistake, it's a general mistake, is to take a medication that you don't actually need. There are a lot of drugs prescribed in this country to healthy people to make their numbers look better. And I'm thinking in particular of cholesterol numbers, but there are some other numbers.
These would be the statin drugs that have consequences. Go further with that. And is this a medical mistake or is this a patient mistake?
I think it's both.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that we all see those commercials on television that encourage us to ask your doctor for whatever the brand name for the medicine that you've seen advertised. And, you know, I think a lot of times people assume that changing a number is going to have some kind of wonderful impact. So if you could get your total cholesterol under 200, that's good. If you could get it under 160, that's even better. And so there's almost this competition. You know, what's your cholesterol? Oh, I got mine down to 145. Oh, well, I'm getting mine down to 130.
And the problem is that the research does not show that lowering cholesterol in healthy people will keep them living longer.
So do you count
it to heart attacks?
You count it to be a medical mistake then if I see my television program and it persuades me that a particular cholesterol reducing drug is right for me based on the happy people that I saw on the television program, and I go to my doctor who tests
who
my level.
Who has only 7 minutes.
Right, and I say, I want this drug, and is it a mistake if he gives it to me when he doesn't tell me about the consequences of the drug and that maybe it won't be all that big a help for me?
In a sense, it is a mistake, but given the fact that he's only got, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, and trying to talk you out of this drug is likely to take him 15 or 20 minutes to explain to you what all the research says, compared to writing a prescription, which takes less than 2 minutes, you can see why a lot of doctors write these prescriptions.
There's another serious screw-up that happens when a prescription is written in a doctor's office. And that is the side effect information is quite frequently not transmitted in a way that the patient can remember it and utilize it. Let me give you an example. One of the most commonly prescribed drugs in this country today is lisinopril. It's what we call an ACE inhibitor. It's prescribed for high blood pressure, and there are a number of them. For example, ramipril, captopril. There are a whole bunch of these drugs. They're marvelous drugs. Don't get me wrong. I think they're fabulous drugs to lower blood pressure and reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes and complications of diabetes. Problem. There's a very common side effect associated with this kind of medication. It's a cough. It's hard to know exactly how many people will get a cough, but it may be as many as 10 to 25%. It's, I would say, a super screw-up if a doctor writes a prescription for an ACE inhibitor and does not tell the patient, be on the lookout for a cough. It might happen in a week. It might happen in a month. It might take 2 or 3 months. If you develop an uncontrollable cough that doesn't respond to cough medicine, by the way.
And that isn't part of a cold.
Let me know. We'll change the medicine. We have heard from so many people who develop this cough. It keeps them up at night. Sometimes it makes them throw up. Sometimes they actually end up urinating in their pants because of the cough, because it's so violent. And they don't know why. And they can't get rid of it. And they tell their doctor, and their doctor says, well, go see an allergist. You might have an allergy. And they get worked up for allergies or sinus problems or something. And nobody goes, wait a minute, it's the lisinopril. Let's change the medicine. Now, of course, that does happen, but far too often it doesn't. So here's the bottom line, DG. When you get a medication from your doctor, ask, what are the most common, what are the most serious side effects associated with this medicine, and write them down. Take them home and store that piece of paper in a place that you'll be able to find it. Double check with the pharmacist. And then if you get one of those side effects, find out how to report it and report it promptly.
Well, one of the other medical mistakes, this wasn't at the top of your list, but it was an important one. And it was ironic in the sense that I used to listen to y'all and I'm on the radio urging, reminding me that generic drugs were, just as good as, save some money.
You have a good memory.
You all, and I've adopted that, and you've changed your minds, and you think doctors should change their minds as well because generic drugs are not exactly like their brand name. The quote equivalence.
The difficulty with generic drugs is a really complicated problem. And again, it's a systemic problem that is going to be really, really difficult for any individual doctor or patient to solve by him or herself. And the problem is that most now of our medications, that includes some of the name brand prescriptions as well as the generic drugs, but most of our medications now are no longer manufactured in the U.S., where theoretically, at least, the FDA is monitoring their manufacturing process. Drugs that are imported from India and China, the FDA has no control over the manufacturing process in those plants.
Well, we won't say no control.
Well, very little.
But for the vast majority of those manufacturing plants, and it's not just India and it's not just China.
No, all over the world.
It's Brazil, it's Mexico, it's Thailand, it's Indonesia.
Lithuania.
So many of these drugs are now being outsourced. And the FDA doesn't have the resources at this time to investigate the manufacturing plants. What that means in essence is that when you go to one of those big box pharmacies and get your $4 prescription filled, it's almost guaranteed coming from one of those other countries. And it's just hard to know what's in it, how well it was made, the quality control issues. And so we're not suggesting that you give up on generic drugs, as you pointed out so accurately. For 25 years, we were some of the biggest boosters for generic drugs in this country, way ahead of physicians, way ahead of pharmacists in that regard. Now we're urging some caution. What we're saying is pay attention to your body. Keep a record of your numbers, if it's blood sugar, if it's cholesterol, if it's your thyroid levels and how well your thyroid gland is working. Keep a diary so that if when you change from the brand name to the generic or one generic to another generic manufacturer, you can see whether there's a change in your numbers. Also, pay attention to how you feel, the subjective reaction, depression, for example, or anxiety or any other measure of how well the medicine might be working. If you suspect there's a problem, let your doctor know, let your pharmacist know, and then try and find a generic that works for you and stick with that manufacturer.
Now, to find out which manufacturer it is and to request that manufacturer for your generic pill is going to require extra effort. Almost everything that we suggest in this book to stay safe requires a little extra effort on the patient's part. We can't just sit back and relax.
Well, I like to think of it, sadly, as a minefield. And so you're entering a minefield. When you go into the hospital, expect mistakes. It's your job to find them or your advocate's job to find them before harm is done. That's true whether you get a prescription or a diagnosis. We're trying to give you a blueprint. We're saying this is an active partnership between you and your physician and you and your pharmacist, you and any other healthcare provider. Everybody has a responsibility. You just can't sit back and hope that everything's going to be fine.
Well, we're visiting with Joe and Terry Graydon, talking about their new book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. We'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Terry and Joe Graydon. They're the authors of Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. This is just sort of a reaction from a reader to your book, and particularly on the generic reports and the idea that physicians make some mistakes and so do we as and pharmacists and so do we as patients. And the manufacturer abroad worried me, but what the new information that you gave me that really stunned me is that the generic protection or the generic pill or the generic drug might have the same ingredients, but that if the patent-protected delivery system is not the same, it could wildly have a negative impact on the ability of that mixture of drugs to get into your body at the right times. That was startling information for me.
It startled us as well. And this is a problem at the level of the Food and Drug Administration. What we discovered in investigating one antidepressant in particular called Wellbutrin XL300, which was developed right here in Research Triangle Park by GlaxoSmithKline, originally by Burroughs Wellcome, was that when the FDA approved the generic version of that drug, they allowed quite a different formulation from the brand name to the generic. So it turns out that there's a patent on the way the medicine is actually released, and that patent doesn't necessarily disappear when the generic drug becomes available.
So to get a real true generic, you got to wait till all patents disappear.
And we don't know quite honestly how long the patent lasts on the delivery system. So as a result, the generic companies have to come up with a substitute, a different way of delivering the active drug, especially in the case of these long-acting medications. In this particular case, what we discovered was that the FDA approved a completely different way, and the drug released its active ingredients in a completely different way. That was a total surprise to us. I think it comes as a surprise to physicians and pharmacists as
well.
Well,
it sure knocked me off. It it was almost like you guys have been telling me it's the same.
The same compound, and it is the same compound, but it isn't necessarily going to act the same way.
Yeah. Terry, this was, I mean, you all explained this so well, but that in this type of antidepressant, it's real important to have the release of the substance go at particular times. And if that varies, you could have not only not have the good results, you could have a very bad result, and that this could happen in a generic drug that could be approved by the FDA. It's terrible.
We think it's important, but the FDA does not agree. Now, we have gotten the stories from hundreds and hundreds of people who have had difficulty with the generic for this particular antidepressant. And so we see this as a problem. But the FDA has said we'll look into it. And basically what they said after they looked into it is, we don't think this is an issue.
Well, ironically, this is on the other side, and this is not a criticism of your book, but an observation. And that is that here's a drug that, when not delivered exactly as the original patented drug works, it is devastating. The other drug seems to work effectively to do what it's supposed to do. On the other hand, you all are skeptical about antidepressants. And you say on the one hand, hey, it doesn't work right. And then on the other hand, you say, gosh, measured against placebos, antidepressants don't do so well.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that almost all of the antidepressants that are available today, or at least the majority of them, are actually approved by the FDA for treating major depressive disorder. And most of these drugs are being prescribed to people who have mild to moderate depression, not major depressive disorder.
And the distinction is important because the clinical trials have only shown effectiveness in major depression. In most of the clinical trials, the benefits of these drugs for mild to moderate depression, for which 75% of the prescriptions are written, the evidence isn't there. DG, we live in an era where every doctor you talk to these days will say, we worship at the fountain of evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. That is the standard. And you ask them, can you show us the evidence on the effectiveness of antidepressants, especially the Prozac-type drugs, for mild to moderate depression? They can't, because they're barely better than placebo, if at all.
Well, it's interesting. I guess that the idea is that on the mild to moderate, it usually is something that is going to self-correcting over time. You're going to work your way out of it. You're unhappy, and a medicine is not the key to getting better. Whereas severe depression is often caused by
severe
a chemical.
Depression is very serious. It has to be treated. It can often lead to suicide, and the medications can be beneficial. The problem is that the antidepressants that are prescribed for mild to moderate depression, because we don't have great evidence that they work, but we do have evidence that they cause side effects, we need to use them very cautiously.
How do you deal with how do you explain this to a doctor who's got a patient who is depressed, and for them, they would rate it deep depression, and say, my neighbor is taking such and such a drug, and it's really helping. Would you give it to me? And the doctor said,
you're back in the problem of bringing your advertising into the doctor's office and saying, would you prescribe this drug for me? And the doctor having to take 20 minutes, 30 minutes to explain to you why the drug isn't really as appropriate for you as the TV commercial made it seem. The same thing is true only in spades for the antidepressant drugs. There are effective ways to treat depression without medications, but they require a lot of effort on the part of both doctor and patient.
Well, then, Terry, is it fair to say that some of the causes of these top screw-ups that doctors make is our advertising of drugs that condition patients to ask for things that may be harmful to them?
Oh, yeah. I think that letting drug companies advertise directly to consumers is a major screw-up. Now, I don't think we're likely to be able to put that genie back in the bottle, but I really think that's a terrible mistake.
And I also think that doctors have a responsibility to stay on top of the literature. They're so busy. We've already talked about that. But they owe it to you, the patient, to know what the scientific literature and the evidence actually say about the effectiveness of the medicines they prescribe.
Well, we're running out of time, and we haven't gotten as many of the top screw-ups as I'd wanted to. But one of the things that I thought was most helpful about your book, because I was left with, I can't trust the pharmacist, I can't trust the doctor, I can't trust the hospital to do the very best job of measuring the kinds of medicines that I might be taking. And you all have given a couple of websites where a patient who is equally skeptical can take his meds out and make the check. Is that really work?
It can be very helpful. And if you have questions, you should definitely ask your doctor questions. You should ask your pharmacist questions. What we want is not for people to say, I can't trust anybody, but to say, I need to be an active member of this team. It's my responsibility to make sure that that I'm checking up as well as everyone else is.
What we've tried to do, DG, is give people tips and tools. What questions to ask your physician to reduce diagnostic mistakes? What are the top 10 tips to stop hospital screw-ups? When you have that list, when you have those questions, and you become engaged with your healthcare providers, whether it's your doctor, your pharmacist, your nurse, whoever it may be, we think you'll be a safer patient.
Thanks to Terry and Joe Graydon for being our guest and for their book, Top Screw-Ups Doctors Make and How to Avoid Them. We'll have the website linked to the book, to the Graydons, and also to this website where you can check your meds. Thanks.
Thank you, DG.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking. I'll be back here before you know it.